accession number 13670, Reel 3.
Colonel Jones, Reel 3.
I was asked to lead with 8 platoon, as I knew the area from my patrols carried out previously. There was a bank with a hedge on the top and a ditch leading straight from our position towards the left-hand edge of the Chateau de la Lawn, where the perimeter wall was. And we advanced both sides of this until we got almost up to the perimeter wall. When we came under tremendous machine gun fire from forward right, I and three of the riflemen dropped into the ditch. The rest of the platoon were either wounded or killed or forced back, except for the platoon on the other side, and I could see them continuing to advance. There was one of the Churchill tanks there with its turret completely blown off and burning fiercely with the fuel from its flamethrower. A German tank or anti-tank gun had waited until the Churchill was within a few yards and had, as I said, blown its turret completely off. As I looked at this other section of mine, the other side of the hedge, a cluster of mortar bombs fell amongst them and they all fell. We were trapped in this ditch, the three riflemen and myself. We couldn't get any further forward because it was blocked by a dead cow, and the slightest movement drew tremendous small arms fire from our right. One of the riflemen was hit, I thought, in the shoulder, but actually the bullet must have gone right through his body because he died in a few seconds. One of the other riflemen had a bullet lodged right across the barrel of his rifle. So we waited there. There was nothing very much we could do at the moment. We waited there, expecting the second wave of tanks and infantry come forward, but none came. So as dusk fell, we made our way back to the battalion, to the headquarters in the Chateau Lalondale itself, and found that we'd suffered very serious casualties, several hundred during the day, including the CO who'd been wounded. That was our second CO. The first CO had been killed, Colonel Burberry, on the beach. And we were discussing this before. The battalion was never really the same again. It had lost its core of original officers, NTOs and men. And although within a short time its numbers were made up by the 5th Kings, who'd been the beach group in our area, and they made up our numbers in officers and men, the battalion was never really the same after that. The next day, they decided that it must be a brigade attack, and the 2nd East Yorks and the Suffolks put in an attack and captured a position, the Suffolks in particularly suffering very heavy casualties. And they found, when they eventually captured a position, that there were between 30 and 40 enemy tanks dug in the position, which was in fact what we had kept reporting from our patrols, and that really it wasn't a battalion objective at all. It was at least a brigade task to take it out. But after that, of course, we had our first real respite for some days.
What kind of impression regarding effectiveness did the crocodile flame-throwing tanks make on you?
I would have hated to have been at the receiving end of them, but of course they were relatively limited in number, and the Germans did have, as we just said, a large number of tanks and anti-tank guns, and they could choose their own time. And I think there were a large proportion of Hitler Youth there who were quite dedicated to defending the position.
What kind of effect on your attitudes and emotions did all these losses in your unit have on you?
I think this, you asked me before, were we afraid? I think this is when we began to be scared as to whether we would survive. The losses were heavy.
Was there any sense in which you were becoming callous?
I did quite hear you.
Was there any sense in which you were becoming callous by now?
I think one, unfortunately, is always glad that you're not the one that's being killed, if that's what you mean. I think there's always this feeling that I hope it's the other chap and not me. But callous, no. And I think, strangely enough as well, you begin to have a certain grudging respect for the enemy as well, who are fighting in circumstances similar to yours and probably receiving rather more punishment than you are, in the sense of artillery concentrations, victor salvos, and so on.
But did the casualties to your own comrades embitter you towards the enemy?
No, I don't think so. I was fortunate in the sense that I didn't really know any of my platoon or other officers intimately. I hadn't really been with them long enough to have struck up a close friendship. Later, I got to know them, the officers in particular, better. And then I think it made a bigger impression on you when you lost them.
Now, you were just about to tell me about being pulled out of the line again.
Well, no, we weren't actually pulled out of the line. We just left there. But it had become a relative backwater by then, and we were left there for some time, and on the 7th of July, talking about the enemy having heavier bombardment than we are, a large number, several hundred Halifax bombers came over and bombed the German position to Caen, and most of the city of Caen was captured by 43 Div. So we had a respite then until July the 18th, which was Operation Goodwood, if you remember. There's been a lot of argument about whether this was really intended by Montgomery as a breakout by the three armoured divs, the Guards, the 7th and the 11th, or whether, as he later argued, it was to draw the enemy forces, particularly tanks, onto the hinge. But as far as three divs were concerned, their task was to broaden the corridor round the flank of Caen, that would be the left flank or the east, so as to allow the armoured divs more room to manoeuvre. But it was a very cramped position because it was in fact exploiting the airborne bridgehead, and it was very narrow. The again, it was preceded by an aerial bombardment. The attack of 3D was to go through 51st Highland Div, who were holding a position there, and they'd been drawn back a few hundred yards so as not to get involved in the bombardment. And we, again, the South Lancs, led the attack, capturing a small hamlet called Le Pré Baron. And A and B Company were in the lead. We formed up in the rear of the 51st Highland, just south of a village called Herouvillette. And we had a number of unfortunate factors there. First of all, we were heavily engaged with the German multi-barreled mortars that had the nickname, if you remember, of Moaning Minis. We hadn't considered these particularly dangerous before because we'd be dug in, but we weren't dug in there. We were only afforded whatever natural cover there was, a few banks and ditches and so on. And we had quite a number of casualties even before we set off. We had a long way to go before we reached our start line. And when we passed through 51st Highland, we were going through dense undergrowth that would have been difficult to have made your way through anyway. This slowed us down, so we lost our supporting barrage. And the enemy fire seemed to be some kind of light, quick-firing anti-aircraft guns firing in a ground roll. Fortunately for us, as we were fighting our way through this undergrowth, D Company came round from the right flank and rolled up the German opposition. So we were able to advance then and take our first objective. On the next day, the East Yorks captured Tooferville, which was the next village. And on the day after that, that would be the 20th, the Suffolks captured Sanneville. And that had received the full force of the bombardment. And we moved forward to relieve the Suffolks. And the scene was quite incredible. It was like something on the moon. There were these huge bomb craters, about 20 or 30 feet across and quite deep. One or two German tanks had just been flung on their upside down like toys. And the whole ground was pulverized. It was almost impossible to dig a slit trench because the soil just slid back in to the hole. And the only thing to do was to take doors and timber from what few houses remained and shore up the side of the slit trenches. And when it started the rain, which it did later, all this pulverized soil turned to glutinous mud. However, I'd hardly arrived and put my platoon in position when I was sent for by the CO, and he wanted me, as one of the few experienced officers left the battalion, to carry out a platoon, a patrol on my left flank, on his left flank, to find out what was there. Was it the enemy or our own troops? It was getting dark then, and my men were pretty exhausted, so I did what I had found was a good practice. I took just one experienced corporal with me and we moved off, and that area was surrounded by a railway line on an embankment, and we got to this railway line and climbed up the top and looked down the other side of the railway embankment, and there was a ditch and a hedge and a group of trees. And we could hear troops digging in there, but we couldn't tell where they were. So I said to the corporal, "You stay here, I'll go down and see what's happening. If I don't come back, you assume it's the enemy and you better go back and save. So I walked down the bank, crossed the ditch, threw a hole in the head and literally stepped into the middle of an O group of the Lincolns from 9 Brigade, who had had a lot of casualties that day, and they thought they were isolated. They were very pleased to see me. So we arranged for patrols to contact each other during the night, and it turned out this group of trees was in fact an orchard, which you've perhaps heard of. The Lincolns dubbed it Black Orchard for obvious reasons. 2 days later, on the 22nd, we were ordered to relieve the Lincolns in one of the most difficult operations in warfare that is possible to imagine, that is, a relief under close enemy observation. We managed this, however, and we took over from the Lincolns, but typical of the sort of problem, the second-in-command reported to the CO that the takeover was complete, and a shot rang out and the CO fell mortally wounded with a sniper's bullet in his neck. That was Colonel Bolster. You asked me about mosquitoes. This was a position in this orchard was low-lying and flooded. In fact, I had to sleep on a jerry can in this slit trench in order to keep my head above the water. And there was a particularly virulent type of mosquito there. I remember the adjutant, Arthur Rouse, was so badly bitten, his face was swollen, he couldn't see. And so much so, the lower in close contact to the enemy, and were being shelled and mortared and sniped continually. Some of the chaps preferred to sleep outside the slit trench to get away from the mosquitoes. They must have been able to see most of what was happening, because the half track, which contained the battalion headquarters, signals link with brigade, must have been visible, because the Germans mortared it until they hit it and set it on fire. So we had a very unpleasant time there. On the 26th, we got a new CO, a Colonel Orgill, and he arrived with reinforcements, which included 2 Canloan officers. Canloan officers, if you don't know what happened, was we were getting very short of junior officers at the time, and the Canadian Army had a surplus, and they asked for volunteers. And 2 officers came, one called Cope, and the other called Fryer. And here again, I got a piece of good luck. Lieutenant Cope came to relieve me, and I was to go back to battalion headquarters as intelligence officer, because Lieutenant Black, who had been IO up till then, had been wounded in this attack. So instead of being absolutely in the front line in direct contact, you moved back 100 or 200 yards, which made a lot of difference, actually. So that was, as it were, the second phase of my campaign in Normandy. I became intelligence officer there. And one of the first things I had to do was to brief and send out the other Canloan officer, called Fryer, on a patrol. And I better describe Fryer. He was a very powerfully built chap. He'd made a very good prop forward. And he went out on patrol on this night of the 26th. And he'd only gone 100 yards or so, and he came to a ditch, and he stepped across the ditch, and with one foot either side he looked down, and there were 2 or 3 Germans fast asleep in this ditch. And just then he looked to his right and saw a flickering light, And guessing correctly what it was, that it was the German NCO going the rounds of his section, he waited, and as the German came, he clapped one hand over his mouth, the other round his body, lifted him up literally and carried him back to our lines. And I think this illustrates what I was saying, that we were having a pretty rough time, but I think the Germans were having an equally rough time as well. We were there for a fair period, and then on August the 2nd to the 10th, we were taken back to a rest area and had a break. And then we were moved right over to the other side of the Second Army bridgehead and began an advance down the Via Tanchebray Road. The enemy were withdrawing. We didn't know at the time, but they were helping to hold us up while the main bulk of their forces withdrew from the Caen area. And this ultimately led up to Falaise. So again, we didn't know this. In fact, this was the interesting thing. I suspect that the average Englishman at home reading his newspaper knew more about the big picture of what was going on than we did in the front line. But the enemy were withdrawing down this road through undulating country. It was rather like going across the grain of the Cotswolds. So you get dips and then a rise. And on the top of each rise, the Germans, who were conducting a very skillful withdrawal, would have an anti-tank gun or a tank and a few men with automatic weapons. And as we advanced with tank support down the road, they bring us under fire. And as we spread out in the field, they then call on mortar or artillery. And we would plan an attack on the position. And by the time we got there, they had withdrawn to the next one. So they were fulfilling their task very skillfully of holding up our advance. When we came to a point on the map which was just 272, which I imagine was metres above sea level, there was a larger element than usual holding this position, and the carrier platoon was sent forward on a recce. And owing to a misunderstanding where they thought some German troops were in fact ours, they came under fire, and Sergeant Major Coombs, who was again one of the characters, long-serving senior NCO and the backbone of the rugby team, was killed, and Neville Chance, who was again a regular officer and a support company commander, was badly wounded. However, we did clear that position ultimately, but in the meantime, sometime about now, I'm not sure it was actually that day, we made our first contact with the American cavalry, who were in fact equipped with armoured jeeps with heavy Browning machine guns, and they appeared on our right flank. And a very young lieutenant colonel drove across in one of these jeeps and had a conversation with me. What did I know? And we exchanged views. I should really be able to imitate an American accent here, and I'm afraid I can't. But anyway, I said to him, well, what we really want to know is what the German strength in Tanchebray is. And he said, well, we kind of wondered that too, so we thought we'd go and have a look-see, but there were a lot of Germans there, so we came back again. Anyway, he wished us good luck and shoved off. And the CO, who was then Colonel Swazi Waller, or was he second in command? Doesn't matter. Anyway, said to me, well, that was quite a normal conversation, Eddie. I don't know exactly what he expected, except he would keep calling you lieutenant. So we then went. Now, it must have been second in command because it was Colonel Orgill. And I then went to a Brigade O Group. You've perhaps heard about this before. It's been well documented, but I'll tell you my version. It was Brigadier Cass, known as Copper Cass. He was a short, stocky chap with a fiery red hair. And he was holding an O Group in this farmyard on the eastern outskirts of Veer. And if you can imagine, it was a large cobbled courtyard entered from the road with stout farm buildings round three sides of it. And the brigadier was sitting at the back of this U facing the road on a chair, looking rather like a film director on one of these folding chairs. And he had his O group there, which contained the battalion commanders and the supporting other tank commander and so on. And we were directed by military police to put our jeeps under cover of these three buildings while we went to attend the O group. And again, here is another matter of luck. The brigadier said, right, well, straight away, South Lancs, I've got some very simple orders to you. I want you to carry out an immediate attack and occupy this point 272. You better go and get on with it now. So we left the O group while he began to give orders to the rest of them and went to collect our jeep. And as we got inside the building, there was a tremendous explosion, and we rushed outside, and there was almost every individual of the O group except the brigadier lying dead or wounded. And again, we had just moved undercover the building because we'd been instructed to start off straight away. Again, just a question of luck. The first thought was that it had been a mine. But subsequently, they collected bits of shrapnel. There hadn't been any warning whistle or anything. And they found out, or at least they surmised, that it was a mounting gun fired at extreme range, and it had just happened to be a lucky hit. And it was the only shell fired into Veer that day. So we captured point 272. In fact, it had been vacated in the meanwhile, and we received information that Tanchebray was being left by the Germans who were drawing. In fact, another of these amusing factors, it was our water truck that went bombing happily down the road, past our forward position, and arrived in Tanchebray as the Germans were drawing. It realised their mistake and turned hurriedly round and came back again. So we moved into Tanchebray on the 15th and continued our advance. And in the small hours of the 16th, we arrived at a farmhouse at a place called Riviere. And I can remember we hammered on the door of this farmhouse, and the farmer came to the door. And we did the best we could with our O-level French, but he didn't seem to understand, so he left us to it in a kitchen with a red tiled floor. And I remember I fell asleep face down on this floor. Again, we hadn't had